We got one more guest, one more segment here for this Wednesday edition of the show. That is Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter, host on VSiN and contributor to the Point Spread weekly newsletter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam. I know this is the most exciting time of the year, but I'm about ready for this game to be played, and let's get this game over, right?
I am definitely ready for this game to be played. I got a lot of my props already squared away. I got my smaller positions on the game. I'm just ready for this thing to get going, and we still have 4 days, 4 full days until this game actually gets underway here. Boy, we'll talk about Super Bowl 54. Also talk some golf stuff with Wes on this segment. But Wes, when we last talked a week ago, Kansas City -1, -1.5, total 54, 54.5. Nothing new to report really on either end for that.
Yeah, and of course, obviously the bulk of the money is going to come in as you get closer to game time. As people get in, I think probably Thursday is when you start seeing some people come into town, and then into Friday, Saturday, and then, of course, game day. Obviously, it's one of those things where you can't necessarily lay wait to the last minute either to see if you're going to try, and you're not going to get to extract the most amount of line value just waiting until right before kickoff like you would on a normal week. But, yeah, most of the money is going to start coming in later into the week, and then I think from a total standpoint, from a side standpoint, the max that this will go to is Kansas City -2. I don't know if San Francisco, if enough money will have them become the favorite. And talking with Jeff Sherman over at Westgate Superbook USA yesterday, he could see it maybe going to pick. He doesn't see 49ers favorite showing, at least market wide or across the board, maybe one place or so. But in terms of the total, it's kind of, you know, stuck there at 55. You did see some initial buyback when some shops went to 55, but it's one of those things, the people that are coming into town to bet the game, they're not coming into town. And I was talking with Patrick Everson at Covers about this, and they're not coming into town necessarily to bet the under, you know what I mean? I don't know if this is going to reach the highs of the 57s or the 56.5s that we thought it might in terms of like the first couple of days of betting. We're like, man, this thing's going to keep rising and rising. But when it gets to 55, 55.5, that's probably when you get the buyback. But that's what I think underbackers are still waiting, because they know that they might get a half point or a point more than the current total right now.
Yeah, I think that we will see that sharp money on the under that you're talking about that we've kind of been waiting on and sort of forecasting here. What I'm really curious to find out is what emerges as the sharp side for the game. I know that initially we had a little bit of quant money kind of come in on Kansas City a little bit, kind of grabbing some of the pick'ems or minus ones that were out there. Saw a little bit of buyback kind of pull it back down to, you know, -1, -115, stuff like that. But I don't think we've seen a true sharp side emerge for the spread yet. Obviously, we've got, you know, some money on San Francisco money line. People are mostly laying the -1 with Kansas City if they like them. But I think it remains to be seen what the sharp side will be from a side standpoint. Or we could see two-way sharp action on both sides here, because you've got San Francisco with the better defense, Kansas City with the better passing game. And we all know, you know, what the passing game means in today's NFL. I don't really see this side moving much, and I don't see a well-defined sharp side or a sharp versus public split here.
Yeah, I really don't either, to be honest with you, because I think it's going to be, as you lump different types of bettors into these little subcategories, you're going to have casual bettors on Kansas City. You're going to have casual bettors on San Francisco. You're going to have professional bettors on Kansas City. You're going to have professional bettors on San Francisco. So exactly what you said there. I mean, I don't think that there is a clear consensus, I guess, what the sharp play is. I even think when you look, and one of the things I'm always interested in terms of the Super Bowl coverage, even though I don't watch it nonstop because it's like 2 weeks of stuff talking about the same thing, I like to monitor kind of what the media opinion is. Not necessarily that I'm going to follow it. More often than not, I'm going to go against it. But I like to monitor that opinion and kind of see that, because sometimes media opinion, especially for a big game like this, is going to shape general public opinion. And they're going to listen to all the stuff that they see on the big television networks and listen to on the radio and see in terms of what's being written about or talked about. So you've really seen, and we talked to a gentleman that was a producer on the NFL Network morning show the other night. And he said, look, all the opinion, and we've been talking about this game for over a week, obviously being the NFL Network, the opinion's been pretty split. It hasn't been really one side or the other, and it is usually more defined on one side or the other. Not that it's always like 80-20 or 90-10, but, you know, you'll at least get like a 60-40 or a two-thirds, one-third on one side or the other, and you really don't have that yet for this game, and it probably won't emerge.
Yeah, I don't think so. And as we transition over to taking a look at the prop side of things here too, as we talked about last week, kind of introing the prop stuff, as we've kind of talked about throughout the week here, I think this is a difficult one for props because you've got a Kansas City offense that can spread it around, a San Francisco offense that maybe can win this game being one-dimensional with the running game and Raheem Mostert, but maybe can't, maybe needs Jimmy Garoppolo a little bit more. Is it George Kittle? Do they have to find somebody else like Emmanuel Sanders, like Deebo Samuel? You know, does Tevin Coleman actually wind up playing in this game? I think this prop betting market is difficult too, because you have the contrast of styles. You have a lot of options for the Chiefs and maybe more options than we think for the 49ers. Two brilliant play callers, two brilliant play designers. Andy Reid, very good off the bye to the under, as we know. So maybe that kind of holds down San Francisco's offense some. I've had to be very creative, I think, with my prop approach here. What about you?
Yeah, I'm the same way. And I think, look, some of the prop stuff, depending on how much you delve into it, you're obviously going to try to do middles and the like, and see if somebody kind of puts out a bad number. Like, I know a lot of people, I'll give you an example, like Raheem Mostert's rushing yards. I think this was a couple of days ago at MGM Properties. It was around 60 and a half or so juice to the over. And then at FanDuel, it was like 77 juice to the under. So, yeah, you're going to try to work a middle when there's 16 yards and stuff in terms of a discrepancy there. But props to me are kind of a combination of some guys, the real numbers guys, do it with all analytics. And that's all that they do is do numbers. I think it's got to be a little bit of a combination of both. It's got to be a combination of numbers and really examining the stats and the metrics over the season. But it's also got to be a little bit of your gut when it's such a close spread like it is here in Super Bowl 54. So that's what kind of led me. I've played a couple, and I've waited for them to drop a little bit. I did play a couple, not really huge. I played a couple overs, actually, with Jimmy Garoppolo in terms of passing. In terms of completions, especially, or in pass attempts, not necessarily yards, but I went a little bit against the grain because people do like to bet what they see last. And they saw Jimmy Garoppolo throw 8 passes. That literally almost tied almost a 50-year-old record. I think it was Bob Greasy in December of 1973 had 6 passes in the AFC Championship game. Jimmy Garoppolo ended up with 8. I think it's the fewest by a winning team in a conference championship game since that Greasy game in 1973. So, of course, people think, well, Jimmy Garoppolo is only going to throw like maybe 10 to 12 times or something in this game. I don't think that's the case at all. And I don't think that that was a sign necessarily that Kyle Shanahan was babying Jimmy Garoppolo. I think they found something that was working. They found that Green Bay couldn't stop the running game, and it's that old, I'm going to run it until you stop it. And Green Bay never really found a way to stop it until it was too late, and then San Francisco is basically just like running out the clock and running pretty conservative because they didn't have to throw the ball. So why throw it if you don't have to? But I think that they're probably going to have to in spots in this game. Yeah, they like to run the ball, but of course, Kansas City's going to key it on the run, so that's going to force the quarterback to make plays down the field. So I bet some Garoppolo overs. I also bet some Damian Williams overs in terms of his rushing yards. That's the Kansas City running back. He averaged in the two playoff games like a 90% snap rate and got about 90% of the targets out of the backfield. So the Mahomes rushing over prop has been bad. Some sharp guys have given that out. So that means that, of course, has risen. But I think you're going to see Williams have to run the ball a little bit more. And I do think Kansas City will run the ball because that 49ers front four is so fast up front that you got to hit them with some quick hitters. You got to hit them with some draws and some counters. So I would expect Kansas City to run the ball a little bit more than is anticipated.
Yeah, I like that one too. You know, I kind of looked at it as, you know, Williams over, I think it was 81 and a half rushing and receiving yards is one that I took a look at here for this one. Because again, I mean, I do think that, you know, this is a situation where you probably are going to get a lot of Damian Williams. You know, I mean, it's sort of like maybe you kind of take that James White-esque approach if you're Andy Reid here and, you know, use him as a runner, use him as a receiver, try to slow down that front four, because ultimately it's going to give Patrick Mahomes more time in the pocket too. And maybe Mahomes is better on the move, but you know, you certainly want to give Mahomes every opportunity possible to get very comfortable in this game, in particular because you are off of a two-week layoff here where timing could be a little bit of a factor. So again, you try to think of game flow, you try to put yourself in the minds of these head coaches, of the coordinators, try to figure out what they're going to look to do, who's going to match up on who. I think there are a lot of good opportunities here for some of those more, you know, next level game planning types of props. I think if you want to isolate one or two different guys outside of maybe like a Damian Williams, something like that, I think it's very hard in this game.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the way you want to approach it, is just to target a couple players, if from the player prop standpoint, is to really target a couple players and see if you can find some edges. When you get into the advanced stuff of maybe the second and third unit guys, because, look, the quarterback props are always going to draw the most. Mahomes, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of Mahomes overplay in the market just in general. So it's the same thing that the books are going to root for every year, even though this Super Bowl is priced more even, they're going to be rooting for a lot of unders on these props. And that's what they're going to do. So you see the same pattern from kind of the quote unquote sharper guys that are betting these props. I mean, they're going to be betting unders, and books are going to need more unders than overs.
Now, something that I took a really long look at here, and I want to pick your brain about this because I thought it was pretty interesting. I wrote a pretty good article, at least in my estimation, about Raheem Mostert and his chances to win the MVP here in this game. He's generally anywhere in the 5.5 to 6 to 1 range, but it's been over 20 years since a running back won the MVP here. And it's funny because as I was going through, Marshawn Lynch would have won it in Super Bowl 49 if he runs in that final touchdown. He had the stats, had the stat line, but the Patriots wound up winning the game. So then, of course, you know, Tom Brady winds up winning the MVP, but it would have been Lynch. Outside of that, if you go up and down the Super Bowls here, there aren't a lot of cases for a running back to win it. So maybe there is something of an anti-running back bias, but also a lot of these teams that play in the Super Bowl have world-class quarterbacks, and they put it in the hands of those guys here. So Mostert at about 6 to 1 is interesting to me, because I think if San Francisco wins this game, he's the most likely guy to get the MVP, but also you're bucking a historical drought here of more than 20 years. So I thought that was a really interesting side plot to this game.
Yeah, you really are bucking a trend, because it reminds me, and it's been so long ago, even though I'm a fan of this team, I forget the number of the Super Bowl, but you remember the Super Bowl in Miami where the Colts played the Bears, and remember that it rained in the second half, which always makes me think in terms of a Super Bowl in Miami, never believe the weather forecast, because you always get that late afternoon shower, especially people that bet Gulfstream Park down there for horse racing know what I'm talking about. You always get that shower late in the afternoon. But if you remember that Colts-Bears game, Peyton Manning ended up winning the MVP. Now, it's because Peyton Manning was one of the biggest stars in the league, and he finally won the big one. So that's why he got the MVP. But if you looked at the stat line, the guy that probably should have won the MVP that year for the Colts is Dominic Rhodes for the Super Bowl game, who really was the guy that ran the ball real well in the second half and kind of kept the Bears at bay, but Rhodes didn't get the award. Peyton Manning did. And I think last year when you looked at that, Tom Brady didn't get the MVP and it was Julian Edelman, it was probably because, Brady, because that's how voters, when they're voting, the media guys in the booth are going to think like that. They're going to be like, well, he's already won this a couple times, you know, let's give it to somebody else. And I thought Edelman was plenty deserving with all the stats that he put up for the game, but they could have put it to Brady. And I talked about this a little bit during the week in terms of voting for receivers for MVP. That's a little difficult to do because let's say Travis Kelce catches 9 passes and 3 of them are touchdowns. Well, more often than not, that's probably going to mean that Mahomes is going to throw for 4 or 5 touchdowns and Kelce's catching 3 of them. So then they're going to lean a little bit to Mahomes getting the MVP instead of necessarily the receiver. And that's why you see these prices, these short prices for quarterbacks, because if I was liking more of the Kansas City side, I would have thought Damian Williams had at least a decent number value down there in the mid-teens to win the MVP. But it's so hard. I think that's one of the bets that generates the most handle in terms of a prop or an index prop. But it's one of the hardest because you don't get a lot of value. And there's a reason why the quarterbacks are +150, 2-1, or 3-1 to win this award.
Right. And I even went all the way back to 1990 when Joe Montana won it. I included Joe Montana in that. 17 of the last 30 have gone to quarterbacks. 6 of them have gone to defensive players.
Exactly.
So there have only been... Go ahead.
I think, well, I was just going to say, sorry to interject there, I think that's where maybe some of the value is on defensive players. I mean, we've seen the Larry Browns win the MVP, you know, if guys get multiple interceptions. So I'm sure if you look at someplace like Circus Sports where they've got 90 players listed to win the MVP, I'm sure they've got a fair amount of tickets on somebody like Richard Sherman, or they've got a fair amount of tickets on somebody like a Quan Alexander or a Nick Bosa or somebody like that.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, 6 defensive players, only 7 running backs and wide receivers combined. And, you know, Edelman last year broke a 10-year drought for wide receivers. So running backs haven't done it in over 20 years. It was 10 years between wide receivers. It was Santonio Holmes in 09, Edelman last year. I mean, you know, what can you really do with the MVP market? I mean, if Kansas City wins, it's very likely to be Patrick Mahomes. And by the way, a tight end has never won it. So Travis Kelce and George Kittle would have to make history here if they were to do it.
And so, you're thinking if Rob Gronkowski never won it, then who's going to win it, right?
Right. Yeah, that's another excellent point. So I don't know. You know, I was kind of looking at that from a San Francisco standpoint. I mean, how many people are going to expect Jimmy G to do enough to win the MVP here? Not many. You know, if San Francisco wins, does it have to be Mostert? Is it somebody on defense where Patrick Mahomes actually takes really, really good care of the football? I think it's tough. And maybe that factors into the handicap of the game a little bit. If you don't think Mostert can win the MVP, and you know, running backs, again, haven't done it very often, what's the path to victory here for San Francisco? And that's not to say that I'm all about Kansas City. It's just, you know, with all the time you have to think about this game, you kind of think about these different angles.
Yeah, and I think that the fact, and one of the reasons I'm not playing for MVP, but one of the reasons I played some of the Jimmy G's overs is because, look, if this game does go over, that's, you know, you got to think that, and the 49ers, I think, average around 30 points a game. So this is a team, contrary to popular belief, that can score as well. And they've proven that they can win shootouts. They proved it in New Orleans that they could absolutely win shootout. Now, they were very balanced, but Jimmy G threw, I think 4 touchdowns in that game. And close to 300 yards. So he's fully capable of putting up big stats, even though he hasn't shown it in the playoffs.
And a couple other ones here, just that I kind of pulled from the article. You know, Super Bowl 50, C.J. Anderson, 90 yards. He didn't have it on 23 carries, so the yards per carry wasn't great. But that game had 2 offensive touchdowns. He had one of them. Didn't get it. It went to Von Miller. Super Bowl 51. I know Brady threw for 466 and had the big comeback and all that, but James White had 139 all-purpose yards and 3 touchdowns. Didn't get it. That Super Bowl you referenced with the Colts, Super Bowl 41, Dominic Rhodes, 21 carries, 113 and a touchdown. Did have 1 catch for 8 yards. Joseph Addai actually had 133 all-purpose yards in that game, or 143 in that game himself. So kind of took away some of the yards from Rhodes there. Maybe would have had a different outcome. But like you said, you know, Peyton Manning. I mean, you know, is Raheem Mostert a star in the NFL? No. If they can give it to a star, are they probably going to do that? You know, you would think so. I don't know. I think it's a very interesting discussion. And, you know, again, just with so much to talk about here with regards to the Super Bowl, something I think was worth mentioning here on today's segment. But Wes, before we transition over to golf, any other specific props you want to mention here on the show?
Yeah, there's always a couple that I play most every year that really don't have a lot of statistical or analytical backing, but just want some that I always play. I always play, will there be a roughing the passer? And I usually will play the yes, because obviously they're protecting quarterbacks more than they really ever have done. So I usually do that. I usually do the no on the first 6.5 minutes of the game. This is a little bit tough to do with such a high total and a higher than expected or than what would be normal scoring game. But I always believe, and we did see it in the college football playoff where they did not score very early. Now there ended up being, I think it ended up landing 67. So kind of right in the middle where the number, right around where the number was. But sometimes you get that old rest versus rust question in terms of maybe they're going to be a little bit shaky. And if San Francisco, let's say they get the ball first and don't end up scoring, but run 4 or 5 minutes off the clock, well, then you're very close to that 6.5. So it is a little bit of a small plus on the no for the first 6.5. I may end up playing it just because it's kind of a creature of habit. I think it, in my prop portfolio, when I do, I probably end up with like only 10 to 15 props or something, you know, something that's kind of a moderate amount, I would say, in comparison. But there's usually those couple that I always play in terms of that. I don't really play a lot of the lottery ticket props. I do play defensive or special teams touchdown more often than not. I don't know if I'm going to do that yet. Those are kind of ones I decide over the weekend whether I'm going to do or not. So I usually play that, or I usually play like the sacks prop. I think those index props, a lot of prop bettors most years are just kind of going to play what they usually play on force of habit. And if they've cashed more tickets than they haven't, like with me, with that no score in the first 6.5 minutes or score in the final 2 minutes of the first half, you know, usually you just play those just to, as being creatures of habit.
All right. So we switch gears over to the golf stuff here. And we start with a listener question that was presented to us for yesterday's show with Brian Blessing, but I think it's good to talk about with you here as well, Wes. This one from at PK73952 on Twitter said they would like to hear more about golf betting strategies. If you just, you know, we talk about a list of guys that we'd like to win the tournament at good prices here, but are those guys that you also play in head-to-head matchups?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. I mean, when they're correlated, yeah, sometimes I will do that. Not necessarily. I mean, sometimes you'll just find a good price in terms of a matchup of a guy that maybe you don't expect to win, but maybe it's a guy that you're picking on and that you think, hey, they're not 100%, or they're just coming back from an injury or coming back from a long layoff. So there's some that you just use for matchup purposes for that. But more often than not, at least a couple matchup plays, if I play maybe 4 or 5 a week for a tournament matchup, more often than not, at least 2 of them are going to involve somebody that I've used on the futures market.
And then also a second question to that point about bankroll management and about, you know, sort of how you come to what you're putting on, you know, these outright picks at the much longer odds. Are you just betting, you know, a normal unit size on the head-to-head matchups? How do you sort of break that all down with your golf bankroll?
Yeah, with futures, what I break down, I try to kind of even out what the payout would be more often than not. I mean, certain weeks I'll like a middle price guy, maybe a little bit stronger, but usually I'm going to bet more on the 20-1 shot than I, and if I'm betting, let's say a 25-1 shot, then I'm probably going to go half of that on a 50 unit or above shot. That just kind of by default, it varies from week to week, but that's what I do. And what I've been doing a lot more this year with a little bit of success. Now, unfortunately, in Las Vegas, these aren't offered unless, for the most part, unless it's a really big tournament like a major or a WGC or something like that, where I've been betting a little bit more, allocating my money not only for something for the actual future for the outright win, but I've also been playing top five and top 10 because I haven't gotten the first place winner yet here in the first month, but I've hit some decent sized prices with top 10s with guys like Tom Hoge, who I've hit the last couple weeks, who, when you looked at the outright, was 175-1, 200-1 the week before at the Bob Hope and ended up top 10 the last 2 weeks. So you're still making money because of the fact that, look, here in the States and also here in Nevada, they don't offer the each-way betting that they offer in the UK or maybe some of our friends up in Canada that listen have those with some of their shops. And I mean, I wish they would do it. I think it would generate more interest in golf betting, but that's kind of your other way if you want to bet each way betting and you maybe have an offshore or faraway place account where they're going to offer more top fives, top tens, top 20s and stuff like that.
All right, so as we take a look here this week, one of my favorite golf tournaments, this one's on the bucket list to make it out to this one and kind of hang out and, you know, drink all day and watch golf like pretty much everybody else does at this tournament. The Waste Management Phoenix Open down at TPC Scottsdale. First and foremost, what kind of course are we looking at here? What types of players did you try to key in on?
Yeah, this is a Tom Weisskopf design, which he also designed the North course at Torrey Pines, but this is a little bit harder of a course. They've lengthened it a little bit. They've obviously resurfaced some of the greens. So the scoring isn't what it had been, because if you recall, I think it was back in 2013, Phil Mickelson shot 28 under over 4 days, 256, because this is a par 71. And the scoring the last several years has been 16 under, 15 under, 14, 17, 18, and 17. So you're going to get high teens. It's probably going to be the score. Maybe it eclipses 20 under, depending on the weather, if there's really no wind out there or anything, or if they might get a brief shower out there in Scottsdale to soften up the course. But usually guys that I look at in terms of metrics, greens and regulation is important pretty much every single week. If you look at the last five winners, the worst ranking of the last five winners was Ricky Fowler, and he was 13th in the field in greens and regulation. Obviously, the 2 years Matsuyama won, he was first and second. Woodland was fourth in the field. Koepka was fourth in the field that week in GIR. And then strokes gained approach, strokes gained tee to green. Ricky was the ultimate outlier when I was kind of looking at the statistics over recent years. Ricky won this tournament last year because he's number one in strokes gained putting. And sometimes you're going to get those weeks where a guy just puts the hell out of the ball and makes everything, because he was like 17th and 19th, which isn't bad, but usually is not the recipe for a winner here in terms of strokes gained approach and a tee to green. You looked at Woodland back in 2018, he was second in the field in both those categories. Matsuyama the year before was first. So obviously you got to hit good approaches and you have to keep it in play. It's played at altitude, but it only travels about 2% longer in terms of a ball flight. You got relatively fast greens. It's Bermuda pretty much throughout the course. The back nine, especially the last four holes, is where you're going to see a lot of the fluctuation, because you got that reachable par five on 15. Then you've got, of course, the famous hole. The 16th is the amphitheater, where everybody is, you know, all the people from ASU that come to this and all the fans are fairly intoxicated and they're cheering good shots, booing bad shots. That's the par three. And then you get to a drivable par four at 17, just a little bit over 300 yards. So Some guys are going to play it conservative. Some guys are going to go for it and try to reach the green in one and then be putting for eagle on the par four. And then 18 is a longer par four. It's got water down the entire side, a lot of deep bunkers. So you will see some up and down fluctuations in terms of the last four holes, which makes this an exciting event. But I mean, by and large, I want guys that are good tee to green and guys that are good on the approaches. And Matsuyama, who I did end up playing this week, and God, I've thrown so much money down that hole. But this is a course where his poor putting by tour standards, I think, can get offset by his ball striking, because this isn't an event where it's like, okay, you've got to necessarily make everything. If the ball striking's good, you're going to get enough opportunities.
Yeah, Matsuyama, the shortest price guy that you played here, you got him at 16-1. Obviously, shop around for the best prices that are out there. Most of his price is a little bit lower here at this point in time. But who else is on your card here this week for Scottsdale?
Well, one guy I really like, and it's he's got a little bit of a mixed bag here, but he has had success here despite not having a win, and that was Bubba Watson. And Bubba Watson, I think when people look at that, they're like, oh, man, he's kind of a little bit ill and hot-tempered. So maybe these crowds at Phoenix are going to get him off his game. But he's also a guy when he's going well that plays off the crowd and feeds off the crowd. Back-to-back runner-ups here in 2014 and 2015. He's got five top five or he's got top five finishes here in a couple other years, including last year where he was fourth. He was a guy that stood out to me because he very quietly last week was sixth at Torrey Pines. He shot 67, 69, 69 on the south course, which is the more difficult course. He actually shot one over par on the easier course, which was that Weisskopf North course where you saw guys like Ryan Palmer shooting 10 under on that course last week. And, you look at the metrics and just the stats last week, he was third in strokes gained off the tee. He was sixth in strokes gained approach. He was second in greens in regulation. He was first in tee to green last week in San Diego. So this is a guy, I think that he will like this course. And I got him in, you can get him really in the mid-30s, I think, still right now. So I think he's the guy to look at. Brandon Grace, who actually finished second last year when he was totally out of form. Grace won his first event in a little over 2 years. He won the South African Open in January. So I think he's got a lot of confidence. Benny Ahn is another guy that has historically played pretty solid here at 90-1. Chez Reavy, almost triple digits at most books. He actually lives in Scottsdale, and he was fourth and second here the last 2 years. Was second on the tour last season in proximity to the hole. That's another statistic that will kind of matter this week, because obviously the closer the hole, the more chances you're going to have at birdie. And then a couple other triple digit guys, Max Homa, 100-1, Daniel Berger at around that range, 11th or better in three of his five appearances here. So I went a little bit off the beaten path and didn't necessarily go with the John Rahms or the Justin Thomases, but they're favorites, obviously, for very good reason.
Wes Reynolds, who's working and find on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Just a guess here, man. I presume it's pretty busy over at VSiN this week.
It is, and I'm kind of moving around. I'm like the utility infielder, the Luis Oquendo, I feel like, if you will, somebody that moves across the diamond. So doing a couple shows during the day this week, and then the normal green zone slots, because we have different programming that specialize for Super Bowl. So I will be on at various times all over the weekend, and then doing the Sunday night kind of late night autopsy at 11 p.m. Pacific. We're the last show that 24th hour in terms, because we're doing a 24-hour programming for Super Bowl Sunday. And myself and Danny Burke will be the last hour of that programming on Sunday, but I'm also on it other various times. So thanks to everybody that listens and for all the support of VSiN. I'll be on at some random points during the day when you tune in.
Well, like I said, make sure you follow Wes on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for joining me. Good luck with all your Super Bowl stuff, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You too, pal. Same to you.